And good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. My name is Les Schulte. I'm sitting in for David Inge this morning. And our guest this morning is Dr. Suzanne Truppen. Thank you for being here again, Doctor. One of our regulars. So if you have a question about your health, women's health primarily, give us a call, and Dr. Truppen would be happy to talk to you and try to answer your questions. The number to call are 333-9455. If you're outside of the 217 area code, you can call toll-free 800-222-9455. And, Doctor, let me be the first to wish you happy autumnal season.
Thank you.
I think we just started a few minutes ago officially, so
good.
Let me be the first. Thanks for being here again today. And while we're waiting for some calls to come in, I know you're working on some very interesting studies. And so maybe you'd like to enlighten us a little bit on what you're working on.
The biggest study that I'm participating in is called Athena, and it is a study of 45,000 women across the nation. And we're enrolling patients specifically to test a new screening tool for human papillomavirus disease, the HPV disease. There is currently one approved test for HPV, and that is the Digene Hybrid 2 capture test. And this test can be used in women over the age of 30 as a screening tool to see whether or not they have cervical cancer, much like a pap smear is actually used. And it got that approval a couple of years ago, and not many people are getting that as routinely as pap smears because probably insurance coverage doesn't necessarily always cover those tests, and HPV screening tests have been very expensive. So I think as we have more tests available, the costs of getting HPV screening will come down, and we will additionally be able to identify more and more women early in their precancerous stages, which, as we know, is when we have the ability to fight off cervical cancer and actually cure it. And we're hoping that as some of the health decisions people are making, one of the things they don't skip is their pap smear. And we did see a very slight trickle up of cervical cancer last year for the first time in many, many years, actually since the advent of the pap smear. In the 1960s, we've seen about a 70% reduction in the rate of cervical cancer now that people have gotten screened. And we're hoping with the addition of these more effective HPV tests, we could perhaps even get that rate even lower.
And we should mention October is coming up, and October is National Breast Cancer Awareness Month.
Yes, and it has really become quite an activity. I think many organizations do have events that are centered around breast cancer, screening for breast cancer, treating breast cancer, research on prevention of breast cancer, research on new treatments for breast cancer. So it's been very, very exciting. Within approximately the past year, we had the approval of Avista. It is a well-known drug, raloxifene, for the treatment of postmenopausal osteoporosis and the prevention of osteoporosis. But many women may still not recognize that if they're on Avista, it reduces the rate of estrogen receptor positive breast cancer by about 50%. And that study was called the STAR trial, where they compared Avista to tamoxifen. And actually, a branch of the STAR trial went on in our community. It was being headed up in our community at the Carl Oncology Division, but I was an associate investigator with them on that particular project. And we were very excited to get that expanded approval. So it is also approved as breast cancer prevention. So that's exciting. And in October, you can look around. A lot of organizations will be having events in my practice, at Women's Health Practice, towards the end of the month, around the 20th, 21st, 22nd. I'm not the good one with the dates, but I think we have three nights in there where we're going to do an event as well, and offer some free Halo Breast Pap test, which is a brand new test approved by the FDA about 15, 18 months ago, something like that. and it's a screening test for the detection of precancerous changes of the breast, much like we use a cervical pap smear.
If you have a question for Dr. Troopen, give us a call this morning. The numbers are 333-9455, or outside of the 217 area code, the number is 800-222-9455. Is it still true that about one out of four women will have breast cancer in their lifetime?
Well, we've been quoting a rate of about one out of seven.
It's
still extraordinarily high. We used to say one out of nine, but they stopped the figures at age 75. And when they started looking at women older than that, we started quoting a rate of one out of seven. Extraordinarily high.
Let's go to the phones right now. We have a caller on line one from Charleston. Good morning. You're on the air with Dr. Troopen.
Doctor, my question really is about the drug that you were mentioning. Was it Navista or Avista?
Evista. The generic name is raloxifene, and that's R-A-L-O-X-I-F-E-N-E. But Avista, it's an Eli Lilly drug, and they have a very good patient website for it. If you just go to the Eli Lilly website, you can learn more about it. But it is a treatment for osteoporosis. About 85% of women in the United States that are being treated for osteopenia, which is low bone mass, or osteoporosis, or prevention of either of those conditions, are actually being treated with bisphosphonates. And as you may know, that the drug Fosamax and the drug Beneva those drugs, there are four different bisphosphonates that we use in the United States, and we have Avista as a potential alternative as a treatment with a bisphosphonate.
Well, I had trouble taking the Beneva and one of the other ones. When I took it, it made my bones ache. So I'm looking for an alternative, and I heard you talking about the Avista, and I thought, well, that sounds like a great alternative.
Yes, we don't know why some people get the aching bones with bisphosphonates, but some women do. Of course, the most common side effect to a bisphosphonate is the GI kind of stomach upset, esophagitis, heartburn, those kinds of symptoms. And for women who get that, both Beneva and the new Novartis drug, transaminic acid, are approved for intravenous use. And transaminic acid, in fact, a 15-minute IV infusion in your doctor's office and you're done for the year. So it may not be the best idea in someone who actually had the aching, but for people who have the GI upset, it's a great alternative. But Avista is something you may want to talk to your healthcare provider about.
Okay, and is that the one that is actually a nasal spray?
No, that's a drug called calcitonin. It can be used. It has had some studies that showed that it was favorable for treating bone pain, but it really doesn't have good fracture prevention data. And I encourage most of my patients to be evaluated for the other treatments that compete with calcitonin. Also, the very best drug that we have in terms of bone building is a medication called Forteo. It's PTH, parathyroid hormone. And Forteo is actually the only medication that can actually build lost bone. These others, they really slow down the loss and they slow down bone turnover so that sometimes your scores improve. And they're excellent for fracture protection as well. But in terms of the best studies in terms of actually building bone mass, Forteo is the medication that we use, but it is an injectable. It's only approved for 2 years of use, and we generally reserve it for patients who have the more severe cases of osteoporosis or already have fractures. And what I find is many individuals don't know whether they have fractures yet. And in order to know whether you actually have a fracture, there are certain specific types of bone density tests or specific types of X-ray tests that have to be done to determine whether or not you actually have a fracture. It's different than a bone scan for your thickness.
Well, I appreciate the information, and I appreciate this program. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call. Our guest this morning is Dr. Suzanne Troopen. She's an obstetrician and gynecologist with the Women's Health Practice here in Champaign and a clinical professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Illinois. Let's go to line number two. We have a call from Champaign. Good morning. You're on the air with Dr. Troopen.
Hi. I have actually, I guess, two questions. My first one has to do with ovarian cancer and if there's any kind of tests that can be done now for ovarian cancer. It's such a sneaky thing that I keep hoping that they'll come up with something to diagnose it or at least to get an idea if you've got it before it's a killer.
Okay, did you have a second question? I'm sorry.
Yeah, my second question has to do, I was part of the STAR study, and I'm on Avista. And I just wondered, I have a stress fracture in one of my feet, and I just, since it's supposed to be for bone loss, I didn't know if that was anything that should have helped me not have a stress fracture?
Okay. Well, let's handle number two first, since it ties in a little bit with Avista. Stress fractures are not necessarily osteoporotic fractures. And yes, people who are on medication should overall have help with non-osteoporotic non-trabecular fractures, so fractures in the area of bone that aren't necessarily as much of the high turnover ratio, but no medicine will 100% protect against fractures, and a lot has to do with what is fracturing, but in fact, there may be other fractures that you have. Best predictor of osteoporotic fracture is to get a fracture, and so you might want to consider getting to have a chat with your healthcare provider. I can't really try to hedge my speaking here so that I don't treat anyone over the phone.
Sure.
But you might want to get a vertebral fracture analysis. There are certain bone density machines where essentially instead of laying on your back as you probably had a bone density one point in time, you just lay on your side and we can do a vertebral fracture analysis. And if you already have a pre-existing vertebral fracture, you may want to consider something else to treat your bone. Also, many individuals do not have adequate vitamin D, do not have adequate calcium, and I do like to evaluate vitamin D and calcium if somebody is getting fractures that we didn't anticipate.
I see.
Now, getting to your ovarian cancer question, we do use a certain test to screen individuals with high risk for ovarian cancer. So if someone has a familial history, a sister, a mom, or lots of what we call secondary relatives, aunts and grandmas, then they might be candidates for getting pelvic ultrasounds and the blood test CA125 that is elaborated by some ovarian cancers. However, everyone should know that when they go in for their regular pap smear and pelvic exam, part of doing the pelvic exam is to adequately try to assess the ovaries and feel the ovaries. Now, in a bigger patient, some of that palpation technique is more difficult. And in some bigger patients, we use ultrasounds just because we can't adequately feel the ovaries. And so there's a recommendation to do that. There's not a general recommendation to do pelvic ultrasounds or CA125s in the average patient with only an average risk of ovarian cancer, which your lifetime risk for ovarian cancer is about 1 in 70. But we don't recommend that the average patient get that because we get so many abnormals that we might have to chase down. And then statistically, we'd be removing many ovaries, at least 350 to 500 ovaries to find one case of cancer, and we feel that that's too dramatic. And we also feel that there may be better tests in the future. And in fact, there's a new test that was just approved this summer. I believe it was in July. I think I've mentioned it before on the show, but I can't exactly remember. But at any rate, it's called the OvaSure test, and it tests for a number of different blood factors that are elevated in certain cases of ovarian cancer. And they're hoping that this test would be, in addition to running the CA125, again, we really recommend it primarily in at-risk people. And as soon as it came out, the Society for Gynecologic Oncologists, which is a very erudite organization immediately put out a position against the test for average practices, and they felt that maybe not enough experimentation had been done on this test, and there were going to be too many false positives. So I haven't started. I've done the test a few times in certain individuals for various reasons, but it's not something. It's something I'm trying to educate my patients that I might get this test on in the future and encourage them to read about it a little bit. OvaSure. So that's a new one.
I see. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call. If you have a question for Dr. Troopen this morning, you can call us here on Focus 580. The numbers are 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Just in a general,
sure.
How much does genetics and lifestyle play in? I was reading it in heart disease and cancer and in many of the diseases. Osteoporosis. I think I've read something about that too, where genetics and lifestyle play a large part. Depending on what you do now,
right.
Well, the easiest.
To poke fun at is smoking, and there's so much wrong with smoking, and definitely it can lead to heart disease, it can lead to stroke, it can increase your risk for breast cancer, it increases your risk for cervical cancer, and there are just many diseases, of course, all the lung diseases that it causes, chronic emphysemas and so forth, so as well as lung cancer. There are many reasons that when we say lifestyle modification, the first thing that we do is say, what's going on with your smoking? Aside from the fact that it causes wrinkles, makes you look older faster. No one wants to do that. So we have many good strategies to helping people get off their cigarette smoking, and that's the number one lifestyle issue. Of course, next is the consequences of obesity, and it is true that many people can be very active and carry some extra pounds, but as a general rule, as people's BMI increases, and that's your height per weight, and if that BMI increases really strictly due to fat, so your adiposity, your percentage of fat, there might be some people out there with really high BMI just strictly due to muscle mass, but anyone obese, pretty much we can sit here and list many diseases that they are more at risk for, and that is breast cancer, and that is heart disease, as well as gallbladder disease and many other types of cancers as well. They're more at risk for strokes and blood clots. And we feel that it complicates anything that they're treating. And then eventually they're more at risk for arthritis and various joint complications as their weight goes up and their joints age and are not able to handle them as well. So just the smoking and nutrition is quite critical. And it's not even so much, many of my patients may be walking around doing their calculations online. You can jump anywhere online and get a basal body index if you type in your height and weight, but many patients are walking around thinking, oh, I'm a fine BMI, but in fact they have a central carrying of all their fat that puts them at about the same risk for diabetes and heart disease and other metabolic conditions as having an overall elevated BMI. So it's not even so much how much you carry, but it's where you carry it, how you carry it, and why you carry it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It's about 11:25. If you have a question for Dr. Troopen this morning, give us a call at 333-9455, or if you're outside of the 217 area code, you can call toll-free 800-222-9455. Dr. Troopen is an obstetrician and gynecologist with the Women's Health Practice here in Champaign and a clinical professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Illinois. One little article I came across while doing a little research for our program this morning was ovarian cancer is diagnosed by symptoms plus blood tests,
And that blood test was that CA-125.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it really is true that symptoms are critically important, and that's an excellent point. We feel that We've always in the past said that ovarian cancer was the quiet, the silent disease. And now we say, in fact, it was probably more like quiet instead of silent. And that people with bloating and feeling full after they eat and dull lower abdominal pains, those kinds of symptoms are more likely to have ovarian cancer and should be potentially evaluated for ovarian cancer. So in addition, but the worried well, mm-hmm. with zero symptoms, we don't recommend that CA-125 because it's too inaccurate still.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's go to line four. We have a caller from Livingston County on the line. Good morning. You're on the air with Dr. Troopin.
Good morning.
Yes, go ahead.
I have a question for the doctor. What age can you stop getting this pap smear?
Okay, that's a good one. Well, the newer recommendations by the American Cancer Society is that women over the age of 70 can potentially quit getting pap smears based on their risk. But most of us won't really truly stop them quite that young. And we do usually, after the age of 65, go along with the Medicare guidelines that a low-risk individual needs a yearly pelvic exam, but only an every other year actual pap smear. And even for younger women, if they've had 3 pap smears 3 years in a row that are all completely normal, and if, in fact, they have had an HPV test as well that is negative, those individuals that are younger could even go to getting their pap smear every 2 to 3 years. But the caveat is, if you do have ovaries, then we still want you to get a pelvic exam each year. And most of my patients kind of merge the word pap smear, pelvic exam together. And so many of us are a little bit hesitant to tell people that they don't need as many pap smears, fearing that that will translate into not showing up at all and only getting fewer pelvic exams. Also, after hysterectomies, we still have 650,000 hysterectomies done in the United States each year, which has been a number that's gone down, in fact, but hopefully will go down even farther. But of those women, if they no longer have an actual cervix and they didn't have any precancerous change of their cervix, those women can avoid doing pap smears as well.
Okay. Well, I'm almost 80, and I've been told that I really don't need one because my previous smears have been normal.
And that's probably excellent advice. But if you still have a uterus or ovaries, which you certainly don't need to tell us on the radio unless you want to, then we would still say pelvic exams on some sort of regular basis are still worthwhile. And not to say that you yourself are at any risk, but we have seen with the HPV epidemic, we think that about 40 million individuals have HPV disease.
Really?
That's why we're so anxious to get the population vaccinated and make some inroads on that number. But I am seeing much more vulvar and vaginal cancer, and precancerous changes of the vulva are something that your healthcare provider might be able to see when performing a normal pelvic exam. So that's another reason to at least make that gynecologic checkup still part of routine care.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call. The numbers to call if you have a question for Dr. Troopin this morning are 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. It's 11:30 here at on Focus 580. And our guest is Dr. Suzanne Troopin, an obstetrician and gynecologist with the Women's Health Practice here in Champaign. Is it still recommended that a woman receive a mammogram once a year after age 40?
Once a year after age 40. Thank goodness most of the organizations that used to, every organization had its own guidelines for mammography. And I think David and I, over the years of these radio shows, would spend a lot of time saying, well, these guys say one thing and these other guys say something else. But pretty age 40 and above, for the average patient, if you've had a direct family history of breast cancer, you could start as young as age 30. We do feel that mammography is more accurate as we get older. In fact, when we're younger, the density of the breast, all the different glands that we have, and the fluid in those glands makes that reading a little less accurate, which is why we don't start so much younger, because number one, the test isn't as accurate. Number two, the incidence of cancer is so much less in young people. And we go from a rate in young people of about 1 in 2,000 up to, if you're in your 90s, if you're in 100, probably if we were doing a what we call an autopsy study looking for asymptomatic breast cancers, it probably is somewhere between 1 in 2 and 1 in 4 when you get very, very old like that. And that's where we come up with the average risk of 1 in 7. And so we have no specific upper age limit any longer for mammography. Again, we have to weigh, as our patients get older, the benefits of the test and whether or not we're going to use the information in medicine just in general. If we don't need to use the information, we don't need to pay for the test. And as an individual gets older, if they have many other strong medical considerations, or they would not potentially be a candidate to deal with the treatments that would treat a breast cancer, then at that point in time, they can stop getting mammography. But if they're spry and they're healthy, and actually identifying a early breast cancer would help them in preventing disease later on, because we do know that a breast cancer found on mammography is 97% curable. So if you do want to use information, you're healthy enough to undergo treatments for the condition, we recommend even much older patients continuing to get their yearly mammograms.
Mm-hmm. And should a woman do a monthly self-exam too?
Well, suddenly something that has been a strong part of our care of women has come under a lot of questions. There was a study that showed that individuals who had breast self-exams actually got more unnecessary tests than women who didn't do them, because they would find things that they weren't sure what happened. So they'd go into the doctor more and get more tests to chase down these findings that may come and go and not be clinically significant. So the American Cancer Society a couple of years ago backed off on their global recommendations that everybody should do breast self-exam to some verbiage that was, well, if you're going to do them right and get taught by a clinician what doing that exam correctly means, and come up with a plan with your clinician as to when to come in and evaluate things that you are feeling on your self-breast exams. And then even more recently, some of the studies that have pointed out problems with widespread self-examination have come out. And we don't quite know where it's going to settle, if we'll completely remove the recommendation someday. It's not been completely removed, but might go that way.
Interesting. 333-9455, or outside of the 217 area code, 800-222-9455, if you have a question for Dr. Troopen this morning on women's health care. And before we started, you were talking about some other interesting studies you're working on.
I was just going to say, since I did mention the Halo Breast Pap test, which isn't widely available, since I did buy the first machine in Illinois, the recommendation is that that test, as a screening test for breast cancer, be used from age 25 to age 70. So we have another window of opportunity during those years to identify those precancerous cells. And it's about a 5-minute test of very minimal discomfort that is essentially using a medical grade breast pump to try and obtain cells. And it's certainly not been routinely adopted by every organization by any means. So it's a new test. It is covered by many insurance companies, but not by all the insurance companies. But it has the ability to identify what is going on a tissue level and potentially to help reduce those overall number of breast cancer cases, which we've not really been able to identify any other screening tool that would do that. Mammograms pick up breast cancer. They don't really ever tell patients whether she has a precancerous change or not.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay. You know, another thing that I came across, what I thought was kind of interesting is in my mind, I guess if I was just thinking about it, I would have thought breast cancer or cancer was probably the number one health concern of most of us, but primarily women. But it seems to be heart disease is the number one killer of both men and women.
Yes, and we think that about 85% of women have high blood pressure before they die. So getting a proper diagnosis of your blood pressure is very important. And there have been a number of advances in the types of medicines that we can use to treat early blood pressure abnormalities. And actually, that is one study that we're currently participating in. And I really enjoy participating in that study because the beginning parts of the study are wearing a blood pressure monitor for 24 hours to really get an accurate diagnosis when you're at home. Lots of people come in and they see my white coat and shoom, there goes the blood pressure. But that isn't necessarily the most accurate way to diagnose blood pressure. And of course, that doesn't happen to everyone by any means. But we do know that it is a real phenomenon. And we do know that by the time women transition through menopause, they actually have a higher risk of heart disease than men. And yes, women tend to worry more about breast cancer. And again, cardiovascular disease being more silent, the kinds of heart attacks women have, the kinds of symptoms they have, it's actually much more subtle than in men. And many cases are missed in their early phases for women. So we do encourage women to talk about their risk, individual risk for heart disease. And many women who aren't getting their cholesterol properly treated, aren't getting proper prevention of stroke with aspirin, should discuss that with their healthcare provider.
The numbers to call are 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 if you have a question this morning for Dr. Suzanne Troopin. Let's go to line number one. We have a caller from Champaign. Good morning. You're on the air with Dr. Troopin.
Good morning. What do doctors look for when they do a pelvic exam?
Well, typically we evaluate the vulvar area, and then we're looking at the vagina as well. We're actually physically looking at the cervix, and most of the time that is the extent of that part of the pelvic exam, although in addition to the pelvic exam, actual pap smear tests or cultures might be performed. And then we do what's – and those parts of the – first parts of the exam are usually aided by the use of a speculum. And then after that part of the pelvic exam, we do what's called a bimanual exam. And the bimanual exam is looking for the size of the uterus, the position of the uterus, its shape, its flexion, so whether it's kind of folded forward on itself or behind on itself, whether or not it's very mobile. And then we're trying to feel the ovaries, and we're looking for whether or not they are normal size and whether or not we can in fact feel them, and any characteristics that might be abnormal in the ovaries as well. And we're also looking for what we call pelvic masses, so something that is there that's a lump that's unexpected, either related to the uterus, the tubes and ovaries, or something unrelated to those things. And very often, over the age of 40, we use a rectal examination as well to determine whether or not there's any involvement of that portion of the body.
Oh, my. So should a person, in the senior person, have pelvic exams? Because I don't think that's part of my physical.
Well, many older women who do get their care from primary care providers and aren't who have been determined not to be at a high level of risk of cervical cancer seem to have slipped out of getting pelvic exams, but we still recommend that women with uteruses and ovaries get annual evaluations. And it's if you've had a complete hysterectomy, no cervix, no uterus, no tubes or ovaries, then still,
Well,
still there are things that we can evaluate by looking at the vagina, looking at the vulvar area, and palpating as well. So some women who no longer actually need the pap smear part still can benefit by pelvic exams. And if a pelvic exam starts occurring every couple of years in women who are extraordinarily low risk, that's probably safe.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for your call. Our guest this morning is Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She's an obstetrician and gynecologist with the Women's Health Practice in Champaign and also a clinical professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Illinois. If you have a question for Dr. Troopin, feel free to give us a call at 333-9455 or outside of the 217 area code 800-222-9455. It's about 11:42. We have about we can probably take calls for about another 10 minutes or so. So feel free to give us a call. One thing that I thought was interesting, and as I read about health for men and women, is ethnicity. Why would race play a part in whether you get a disease or not get a disease?
Sure, and this does get back to genetic factors as well. And it's possible if we were able to tease everything genetically out that the ethnicity may or may not be so much of a factor. But we know, for instance, just being male or female in Alzheimer's disease, for instance, it's Parkinson's disease, it's two times more likely that a male's going to get Parkinson's than a female. But for there are certain other conditions that certainly are not just sex hormone related that have different incidences in men and women and may, in fact, be related to their hormones, but it may be related to their biology. For instance, with cardiovascular disease, we think it's strictly the fact that women's hearts are smaller and the blood vessels that feed them are smaller, so that that same blood vessel may be completely constricted but produce a different effect. And of course, teasing out of ethnicity, for instance, the component that might be the social component. So in African American women, they're much more likely to be obese than Caucasians, but everybody's rapidly catching up. We're very obese population, as you know. That's been talked about a lot, but perhaps there's certain aspects of the diet that makes them more likely to become a diabetic, although they are just as obese as someone who is not a diabetic. So we don't understand all the factors of ethnicity, and we certainly don't understand all the factors that lead into individuals that have varying ethnicity. So if you're at risk being one ethnic group, are you still at risk if you're half that ethnic group or a quarter of that ethnic group? But we do know there's been this fascinating study called the SWAN study, S-W-A-N, and it's the study of women across the nation, I think is what the initials stand for, but or something very close to that, and specifically looking at menopause in different ethnicities and which groups are more at risk for osteoporosis, which groups are more at risk for hot flashes and so forth. And we are finally having some of these studies well enough done that we can start using the information. So while we have many suggestions that ethnicity plays a role, we certainly have only begun to understand it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can call us toll free. If you have a question for Dr. Troopin this morning here on Focus 580, and we have a caller on line number one from Savoy. Good morning. You're on the air with Dr. Troopin.
Good morning. Hi. I was just thinking of the last caller who was asking how often she should get an exam as an elderly person, and that her general practitioner hadn't been including that in her exam. And I just wanted to make sure that maybe you mentioned that she should go to a gynecologist and not just her GP.
Well, and many family medicine physicians or internists who are doing yearly care do select to have a women's health care provider or a gynecologist do the gynecologic parts of their examination. And, you know, in medicine, we have to be careful we don't lose the forest for the trees. And I'm a big proponent of electronic medical records. I think that helps a lot understanding where we are with our patients in the year. And if a patient sees her family medicine physician a lot. Now, in this case, it sounded like it was going on a long time. But if somebody's coming in a lot for ongoing care of a particular condition, boom, that year may turn into 2 or 3 years and whoops, we haven't quite done a pap smear yet. And so I think that's where we can do a lot better even for ourselves. If we sit down, for instance, American College of OBGYN has guidelines for what regular screening tests and treatments do we do in someone who, for instance, is 20 versus 40 versus 60 versus 80. And I think that that is very, very helpful. And that's where I think that vaccinations are important as well. You get vaccinated against certain conditions, you're less likely to have those conditions. It's all about screening and prevention. And I was reading a story on the cover of the Wall Street Journal this morning, and I didn't read it in depth, but it did say, given the mess many insurance plans are in and the costs of daily life, that skipping checkups was something that people were starting to skimp on their medical care as a way when they're trying to make their healthcare decisions. And I just hope that they involve their providers in saying, okay, what is really cost effective for me to do? And maybe some tests can be on the back burner, but there's never been a question about pap smears, how cost effective they are at preventing cervical cancer. We have something like 500,000 cases of cervical cancer worldwide, and 250 women dying each year of cervical cancer worldwide. And we only have something like 11,000 cases of cervical cancer in the U.S. and only about 2,000 or 3,000 women. And it's still very significant. Of course, each one of the individual's very significant, but still, numbers wise, if you look at it that way, and of the people in the United States who do not get cervical cancer, I mean, who do get cervical cancer, the vast majority do not get regular pap smears. And I myself have diagnosed cervical cancer in patients who have not had checkups or that included a pelvic exam for something like 7 years, 30 years, very, very long periods of time. And it's a very cost-effective, relatively simple exam, relatively non-invasive.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much for the call. The numbers are 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. We have about 10 minutes left of the program. If you'd like to talk to Dr. Troopen, you can give us a call. We'll get you in.
And that's where I was going to say my Athena study can pay for a pap smear. If somebody's looking for a routine pap smear, and she qualifies for our study, I'd be happy to see her.
All right, sounds good. We have a call on line number one from Urbana. Good morning. You're on the air with Dr. Troopen.
Hi. I'm surprised at the number of women who've never heard, who are menopausal or not yet, but it's mainly for women who are menopausal, who've never heard of the insertable ring that's impregnated with a small amount of estrogen called estring or E-string?
I've always said E-string, but yeah, it's E-S-T-R-I-N-G. Well, when it comes to hormone replacement therapy, or which is the giving of hormones if you are prior to your natural age of menopause, or hormone therapy, the giving of hormone treatment after the age of menopause, we're trying to get away from that R if it's a menopausal patient, because she's not really replacing anything. It's a therapy. And there are many, many, many delivery mechanisms. And there was newly introduced an actual spray, EvaMist, but vaginal delivery strictly for the treatment of vaginal and vulvar issues. There are inserts, there are creams, There is a ring that can be used as a short-term treatment, and then there are rings that actually give you a blood level as well. And one thing we have, and of course, if you're using all hormone therapy, we can talk about injections and patches and pills and creams and gels, and now we have the spray. Actually, somebody I think is out there. There's a research study going on now of a sniffable. But at any rate, with the some of the different products, they have excellent profiles and have a lot of reasons why different individuals might be best suited to using that product. But generally, some of the fancier delivery mechanisms aren't necessarily on the top tier of copay on plans. And I think that limits their availability. And I think it's one reason why some practitioners have not really steered their patients so much towards those products.
Well, I'd like to mention that it does make a big difference for me. And I had not heard of it until I went to see the doctor. And, well, my general practitioner, who then referred me for a particular situation to an OBGYN, who then said, why don't you try this? I think it'll make you much more comfortable. And it also seems to have positive effects on the urinary tract system. So I just thought I would point it out in case people wanted to look into that some more, because it's folks I've mentioned it to and have tried it have said, wow.
It's excellent, and thank you for your call. And it's interesting what you say about the urinary tract and symptoms, because some symptoms that are directly related to low estrogen are very well treated by estrogen. But unfortunately, there's been some contrary data. We know that estrogen softens collagen. That's one reason why it actually has been shown to have beneficial effects if you take it systemically on your skin and fewer wrinkles. And with that collagen softening, there's actually some contrary information that says that the use of estrogen actually increases urinary symptoms for certain groups of patients and certain types of symptoms. So I do encourage my patients to tell me if they're having urinary symptoms so we can try to sort this out and figure out what's going to be the best treatment. But thank you for pointing that out.
All right. Thanks very much for your call. Let's go to line number two in Champaign County. Good morning. You're on the air with Dr. Troopin.
Hi. I don't know if you have this on the top of your head, but I'm wondering how ubiquitous is screening for neural tube and Down syndromes, and what is the usual? Do you have any statistics on what happens typically when that screening does happen?
Well, there are a few different types of screening. Something as simple as an ultrasound is a screening for neural tube defects in pregnancy. And I would say that the vast majority of pregnant patients that are getting care in the United States are getting at least one or two screening ultrasounds looking for all birth defects, but including neural tube defects, which are fairly common. For instance, open spina bifida in our population is about 1 in 1,000 patients. Many patients also are being offered serum screen tests. The serum screening tests in the United States usually are quad screen tests, and that is a blood test for alpha-beta protein, the estriol, inhibin B, which is made by the ovary, and the HCG, which is made by the placenta. And the alpha-beta protein is the fetal carrier protein, which leaks across the placental blood hookups with the maternal serum, and it's something that we can detect in maternal serum. And we've had expanded screening for neural tube defects, which would include expanded screening for Down syndrome, which can be a low test. I'm trying to think about how to, I know we don't have tons of time left, so I'm trying to say this succinctly on a very large topic, but there are these integrated tests now that involve doing an ultrasound at the end of the first trimester looking for something called nuchal translucency, which is essentially measuring the back of the neck, and it has to be done by by a sonographer that has been trained to do that and certified to do that. And then there's a blood test, and there are a couple of different ones we use in the first trimester, but we tend to use the PAPA-A test in the first trimester. Then you go on and have the quad screen done in the second trimester with a second trimester ultrasound. We put all those facts together and come up with estimates of your risk, of the woman's risk for neural tube defects and chromosomal abnormalities. But ultimately, if you want to make the diagnosis of chromosomal abnormality, some sort of sample of the pregnancy has to be done. Now, there is another test that's working its way through the pipeline, and I think they hope to get FDA approval fairly soon, that will actually be drawing blood on a woman to look in that blood for circulating fetal cells and doing chromosome analysis. And won't pick up anomalies. You'll still have to use ultrasound for that. But I've heard that test is supposed to be about 95% accurate, but I don't know how soon it will be available. But we're fairly excited about that test because we feel that it's an extremely good non-invasive way of coming up with the accurate diagnosis for patients.
All right. Thanks very much. Thanks for your call. And that actually is going to wrap up our program today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our guest this morning has been Dr. Suzanne Truppen. And Dr. Truppen is an obstetrician and gynecologist with the Women's Health Practice in Champaign and a clinical professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Illinois, and stops by every once in a while to talk about women's health issues. Doctor, thank you very much. And we'll be right back.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. Dedicated to preserving our planet, the Subaru Assembly Plant in Lafayette, Indiana, achieves zero landfill status with nothing from its manufacturing efforts going into a landfill. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910.
And my name is Les Schulte. I've been sitting in for David Inge this morning. It's been my pleasure to be with you here on Focus 580.